There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kia ora, g'day, and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 123, Part 2. My Burb of the Century 2023. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui a Tara, on the rohe of Mue Upoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Ati Awa, and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. It is nearly the end of another year, which means here in Aotearoa, it is time for the most important election of the political calendar, the Bird of the Year. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll know what this is about. But for those that don't, Bird of the Year is an annual vote run by the conservation organisation Forest and Bird. It's quite a contentious vote, but thankfully you don't have to pick just one. You get to rank your top 5 birds from the selection offered. And even better, it's an online vote, so even if you're not based in New Zealand, you can still have your say. And at the end, whichever bird gets the most votes is given the illustrious title of Bird of the Year. This time around, though, it is an extra special election. Forest and Bird was founded in 1923, making this year their 100th birthday. Hooray! To celebrate, they're calling Bird of the Year the Bird of the Century, and added a few more contenders, all of whom are extinct. Some of them you've probably heard of, like the Huia, and others you probably haven't. I've chosen not one, but 2 of these lesser-known extinct birds to teach you about. And in addition to 2 birds, we're going to have 2 hosts. I thought it might be good to bring in some extra scientific knowledge, if you will. So, I invited my partner, Lily, to come on and add their insights into avians and ecology as well. I've split our chat into 2 episodes, each with 1 bird, and both episodes are releasing on the same day. You're currently listening to part 2, so if you haven't listened to the other part, it's already available now. Enjoy. So because I knew that this episode was going to be a bit shorter because of the limited information at hand, I also picked another bird that I thought was quite interesting as well.
I'm pretty sure I remember what this one is.
You probably do remember what this one is, because honestly, this is the one that I found. I don't want to bag the bush wren, but I found this one a lot more interesting, personally.
Well, the bush wren, we have 2 extant species that are similar.
Yeah.
This guy is very interesting.
I do find the bush wren that was interesting, and that I found the similarities interesting, in that the Titi Ponamu and the bush wren are quite similar, and that in itself is quite interesting.
Yeah, I would be interested to try to understand more about why they were hit so much harder, because South Island Titipunamo, again, it's just subspecies, not completely different species. Acanthocetochloris huttoni, maybe? The South Island is not threatened. The North Island one, Acanthocetochloris, chloris, or is that the South Island? Anyway.
No one is going to pull you up on it.
They might. If I'm doing this at work, I have like books and stuff in front of me. It's not like I need to know the Latin name when I'm in the field. Like, oh shit, what is that? on the North Island, they're at risk. And I think some regions do their own threat status. So that would be interesting to understand from a conservation perspective. How has the Titipunamu made it without, you know, they're at risk, but they're not conservation dependent per se. Whereas the rock wren sounds like they got, you know, just obliterated in a pretty short amount of time in the scheme of things.
Yeah. Bush wren, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. You said rock wren.
Yeah. I don't know what their threat status is.
No. Yeah. So yeah, that would be interesting to know why, if they're such similar species, why did they...
It may just be a matter of how close they nested to the ground, because the Titipunamu, they're way up in the trees in little crevices.
It could, that would do it.
Like, I think, like, honestly, most rats I don't think could fit into a Titipunamu nest. Mice could, but not most rats.
Yeah.
Because you watch videos and, like, even these little, like, 6-gram birds have to, like, kind of flatten themselves to squeeze into their nests.
Yeah, interesting. But we're going to move to a completely different bird this time.
Anywho.
They don't actually make that noise.
I know.
So we're going to talk about the Fico. Sorry, I had to...
Okay.
Fico. that's the Māori name. We're going to talk about the laughing owl, which I thought was really interesting because it's such a weird-looking bird and its behaviours are also really weird. So its scientific name is Ninox albifaces. Albifaces? I'm not sure.
I can't see how it's written, so you're on your own. but that's I would not at all have guessed that they're in the same genus as the Ruru.
Yes, they are.
That is surprising to me, because they look so different.
Yep.
They're a very different body shape.
They are. They're about twice the size.
Yeah, they're much leaner. Yes. They're more long.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, I guess the Ruru kind of has the facial disc, which is a trait of strigiformes of owls, for sound reflecting reasons.
Yeah, yeah. So again, these are endemic to New Zealand, and their threat classification is extinct. So in terms of what they look like, they're an owl, so you can kind of, hopefully you have a base idea of kind of what an owl looks like. But as we mentioned before, they're twice the size of a ruru, or a moorpork in English. So they're about 40 to 45 centimetres in length, and about 600 grams in weight. The adults were dark brown with yellow stripes down the edge of their feathers, and their belly was yellower than their back, which was much more brown. Their legs were covered in yellow bristles.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, it was weird because the pictures and some of the taxidermy I saw, yeah, they were like short sort of stalky feathery type things.
Interesting.
So they're technically feathers that are growing out of their legs, but they're not fully feathers, right? So
if you like think like just the main stem.
The main stem with like little sort of feathery bits on the edges.
That's odd.
Yeah, so they're like, it is kind of weird if you look at the pictures. So they have those yellow bristles. And their face or facial disc was pale with some dark brown streaks. And juveniles were more white and yellow rather than brown. Now this description is really interesting because if you look at some of the pictures of, you know, when Europeans were going around drawing all these different animals, the color of that plumage I've just described is not the same.
That's what I was thinking. Like, I've never seen them yellow.
Some of them do.
What you're describing sounds, if it reminds me of anything, probably a barred owl. B-A-R-R-E-D, not B-A-R-D.
Yeah, it's really weird. I might just...
Oh, there he goes. Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of...
Spooky boys.
So there's a lot of difference. So one of the pictures we're looking at now has got a laughing owl. It's a drawing or a painting of a laughing owl with...
Pick a.
It's very brown. It's very, very brown.
He's yellowy on his tummy.
Sure, yeah, he's yellow on his tummy. But if you compare to this one, he's very white in comparison.
Show me the photo again.
So the photo...
Yeah, I guess they are a little more ruru shaped.
Mm.
No neck.
No, absolutely no neck.
Which, you know, anatomically is not true. They have so much neck, but it is
you
not...
You cannot see it.
See it. They have, if anything, too much neck.
Yeah. So they're an interesting looking bird, I think.
Yeah, they do have that sort of stripy back like a ruru does.
Yeah. So that's... yeah, so they're kind of a weird looking owl, I think.
Fair cool.
Interesting to look at. In terms of closest relations, there is or was a North and South Islands population that they're sometimes treated as subspecies, depending on who you ask. Sometimes they're treated as the same species, which is, I think, pretty common for New Zealand birds. Is some people lump them into all one species, and some people split the two islands into subspecies.
Often, it really comes down to genetic data, like if they are genetically distinct populations. So, like, sometimes, like, that's something you'll see on NZ Birds Online, is sometimes they'll say, like, you know, North and South Island subspecies formally recognized but not supported by genetic data or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
So, well, if you've got things that are pretty good flyers, they may have just enough mingling across the Cook Strait that they are not genetically distinct, or perhaps they haven't been separated for long enough.
Yeah, sure. In this case, it was apparently based on some minor differences in size and plumage, which, yeah, is probably not enough for a good consensus.
Well, it's hard to say, is that genetic or environmental?
Yeah, exactly.
If you give it enough time, it'll probably be genetic. You know, if smaller bodies is being selected for in one population, if you give it another 100,000 years, it may start to genetically separate.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, they were thought to sit in their own genus for a little while before they were moved into Ninox, which, as you mentioned before, is the same that Ruru are in. And they're more broadly known as Bubuk owls, because that's what Ruru is called in Australia.
So
Norfolk Island specifically.
Yeah, then the one in New Zealand is a subspecies.
Yes.
So... Ninox Nova Zealandi.
Yeah, and so you actually...
Or is it Nova Hollandi? It's one of those.
It won't... Well, that Nova Hollandi will be Australia, because Australia used to be called...
That's what it is. It's Ninox Nova Hollandi subspecies
Nova Zealandi.
Nova Zealandi, yes.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of different... A lot of New Zealand things have some version of New Zealand as their specific epithet, but like spelled slightly differently. It's maddening.
Yeah, right. So what, something I didn't know when I was researching this is that Bubuk owls are actually found not just in Australia but Asia as well. So if you go on Wikipedia and Google these, it's got a whole list of these different owls that all look like varying shapes and sizes of ruru all across Australia and Asia, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and if you go one step above that, Strigidae, pretty much all owls on Earth are in that. Barn owls are off doing their own weird thing genetically. But Strigidae is pretty much all the owls on the planet. So
it's
not as diverse as, like, once you get into passerines like the wrens and stuff. Holy cannoli. There's like, I can't remember the numbers, but let's say there's 10,000 kinds of birds, which is not nearly enough. Like 8,000 are passerines, like proportion wise.
Yeah. But we don't have time to get into all that.
Nope.
So so for the calls of the laughing owl, again, we don't have any recordings of these guys.
Are you sure? I think they have one in that thing in Zealandia. Or not Zealandia.
In Te Papa.
In Te Papa.
They might, but also I didn't go to Te Papa to listen to it.
All right, we'll go later.
So if you go to Te Papa, you might be able to hear a recreation of... Yeah. I think that's a recreation. It's
It's an original.
No. But again, a description of what people said it sounded like. They described... or I guess part of it is slightly obvious. Laughing owl, that actually refers to what it sounded like. And it was described as a, quote, loud cry made of a series of dismal shrieks frequently repeated.
Same.
End quote. it was also described as, quote unquote, doleful shrieks and a, quote, prolonged cack, 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 end quote.
Cack, kitty, cack, cack, cack.
Yeah.
Katrina, Katrina, Katrina.
which I guess, like, if you think, yeah, like, that does kind of, I could see why someone could interpret that as someone or something laughing.
The laughing gull is the worst.
Laughing gull.
It truly sounds like a human being laughing, and it is deeply unsettling.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hate that.
Yeah. Like, on an offshore island, supposedly alone, just you and some pelicans, and you hear someone laughing.
Yeah.
It's very spooky.
Mm-hmm. So that prolonged cack, cack, cack would happen a lot on rainy nights. And it also apparently sounded like the barking of a dog, of a small dog. Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I can, whatever the sound version of visualize that is, with yeah. like thinking about some other
audialize.
Some other owls in the world that I have heard.
Yeah, and another type of call that they found was they also had a captive pair that would make a call at dusk, which was described as, quote, two men cooing to each other over a long distance, end quote. I thought was an interesting way to describe that.
I love that they specified that it's two men as if that's a thing that human men do.
Do, yeah.
You know, when two men coo at each other over a long distance.
Yeah.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
What?
We've all had that experience.
Also, there are birds that coo. Have you met a pigeon?
Yeah, I don't...
Was it like if a pigeon was a man? Baffling.
Yeah, very strange, but that was apparently how it was described. Two men cooing to each other over a long distance. Which was
how come you never coo at me from a long distance anymore, Thomas? Where's the romance?
Which was, yeah, just everything about that sentence I found really strange.
Because,
like, over a long distance? Like, I don't know, does that mean it sounded more echoey or something? And what made it sound like two men as opposed to just two people of indeterminate sex or gender?
Or perhaps two birds.
Or two birds, which is actually what it was.
Bizarre. I love, hate that about, like, old writings from naturalists where they're so taken with the beauty of the world that they use nothing but subjective descriptions of things. It's like, it sounds as if a woman lost her greatest treasures in the trials of the old war. It's like, oh, great,
what's
great.
That, mean?
That doesn't help me at all.
What does that
we're
mean?
We're clearly moved by this experience, but can I get some more concrete descriptions?
Very strange. So in terms of what they eat, I found this quite interesting of what they eat, because they're an owl, so they're a predator, but they're a generalist predator, which means they hunted basically anything that they could get their claws on.
Not to be shady, but being a generalist predator in New Zealand is not nearly as outlandish as being a generalist predator, say, on a continent. There's really only so many kinds of things here.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you eat a bat, a bird, and a lizard, and maybe a weta, like a big one.
That does more or less include most of what they ate.
That's all there is here.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of animals.
The only thing you really missed there was frogs. They would eat frogs.
Really?
Yep, apparently. They'd eat small frogs.
I'd have to scramble around on the ground to find those.
Yeah. They'd eat small to medium-sized birds. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, bats and lizards. They'd also eat juvenile tuatara and some large insects like weta as well.
I think Ruru still... do that
pretty
they'll crunch away.
So yeah, they ate a lot of different things, but as you say, I guess there's only a certain amount of things actually.
I'm also realizing now that we're discussing this, I have to completely take back what I said earlier about, like, oh, the rock wren has or the bush wren has close living relatives. I see now that the laughing owl does as well. So ignore me, I guess.
Another kind of interesting thing about this was that some of the prey could be up to 250 grams in size, which is just about half the weight of the laughing owl, which
her.
Is about 600. So
damn, that's a hefty bird.
Yeah. So it's half a kg, just over half a kg.
Yeah. I mean, most of the birds I've handled in my life are small songbirds, like 30 grams or less. I guess I've handled a lot of ducks and pelicans, but, you know.
Yeah.
They're birds, but, like, are they?
Yeah.
It's different.
Technically, yes.
Like, they're birds, but they're, like, they're ducks, you know?
Sure, yeah. They're in a, they're their own
I'm going to be scientifically discredited by this.
You said ducks weren't birds.
Like, they are, but, like, they're their own, they're their own deal, you know?
Waterfowl. Yeah. Strange waterfowl.
Anatidae.
Yeah.
And seriformes. Like, they even have their own, yeah.
So that's what they were eating before humans arrived. They were still eating that after humans arrived. But after humans arrived, of course, they brought all sorts of other things with them. And so actually what they found is that the laughing owls would hunt kiore, the Pacific rat, as well. Partially because it was now available. They could, you know, it wasn't here and now it is, so they can eat it. And partially because Māori burnt a lot of the forests where the laughing owls were usual prey resided.
Yeah, the kiore are going to be eating a lot of those prey animals.
Well, that's the other thing.
They would have gone for.
So partially was also because the kiore was themselves predating on the eggs of the other prey. Mm. So there was less of their normal prey for them to hunt. And thus why they kind of switched, not quite predominantly, I don't think, to kiore, but they switched to having that as being a large part of their diet because... Yeah, a lot of their prey wasn't around quite as much anymore due to habitat loss caused by humans. And predation from rats, which I thought was quite interesting. They just apparently had no problem with that. Mm.
That video of that Tieke thrashing a mouse to death. So I hope that catches on as a trend in the bird community. You know.
Mm.
Adapt, I mean, to overcome,
I've seen kingfishers. I've seen kingfisher do it as well.
Oh, yeah.
With rats.
That's kind of more on par with them, though. With the Tieke, it's like, girl, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, that's very unusual.
I love this for you. Keep it up. But what inspired you to engage in this behavior?
Yeah.
Whereas kingfishers, that's their thing. They catch something as big as themselves and then beat it to death.
Yeah. So because they were generalist predators, it wasn't uncommon for their diet to vary. And in the case of kiore, that was their diet varying temporally. But also it could vary spatially as well, depending on where they were. So if the laughing owls happened to live in a more coastal sort of area, they were also known to hunt prions as well. And in more inland areas, they would hunt kakariki or even big worms.
Big worms!
Yeah, big worms, which I thought was cool as well. So
great.
There's a whole bunch of things that they're
there. See, that's so interesting that, yeah, like the... the pepeke and the big worms. You got to be on the ground for that.
Mm.
Which could potentially be a segue into why they're extinct. If they're hanging out on the ground.
Yeah, so it doesn't... I mean, there was nothing I could find that explicitly said kind of how they hunted. But it does give the impression that they were maybe, scrumbling on the ground.
On the ground, like rummaging around in the leaf litter to find the frogs and the worms.
Mm. And a lot, and depending on the species of bat, that's where the bats were hanging out as well, was on the ground.
Mm.
So yeah, like it seems to be that they'd be scratching around on the ground quite a bit rather than...
I prefer to imagine mid-air combat because it's cooler, but it could be both.
It could be both. So in terms of where they lived, they were found throughout the mainland. But when Europeans arrived, sightings were only recorded south of Taranaki to East Cape. So if you think of where Taranaki and the East Cape of North Island... only south of that, they were never seen north of they were never sighted in northern Waikato, in Auckland, Coromandel, you know, all the way up Northland, that kind of area, just never seen in those areas. They were also only recorded apparently in Nelson and Marlborough and on Stewart Island. So it doesn't seem like that they actually had a massive area in the South Island either that they were hanging out in. And it's not, as far as I could tell, not super clear if that's actually where they were found. in terms of, like, they've always been in those areas and just nowhere else, or whether they'd been, you know, whether they'd gone extinct in those, in, like, Canterbury and Otago, for example. I suspect probably they were in those areas and then just not there anymore when Europeans turned up, or when they decided to start recording this information, because otherwise I don't quite know how they'd get all the way from Nelson to Stewart Island. That's quite a long distance. In terms of the type of habitat they were hanging out in, they were in open grassland in the South Island and in forests in the North Island. They'd make nests of dried grasses, which would be made on the ground in caves.
Aha! Just as I suspected.
What?
Nesting on the ground. Can't be doing that.
Nesting on the ground.
Can't be doing that.
They are nesting on the ground.
Stop leaving your babies on the floor. They will be snatched.
So they'd make these nests, I thought, which was really interesting, in caves, cracks in rocks, on rock ledges, under boulders, and possibly in the holes in trees. Which I believe is quite unusual for owls to be.
No, the cavity nesting is on par.
Right.
But in a rock crevice or something like that, that's pretty odd.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at an owl's nest, a lot of times they'll be just sort of just, they'll kind of just fling it up into somewhere. But like, you know, they do a little better job of hiding it usually. Yeah. Yeah, the caves thing is very interesting because that's kind of limiting you to certain areas. You'd need to, like, I mean, I guess there's a fair number of limestone-y areas in New Zealand, but that's very interesting.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, like flying, like so many other things, if you're not having the predation pressure to build your house and have your babies 50 feet off the ground, it is a lot of work and comes with its own risks.
Yeah.
Just like flying is extremely costly. You're not going to keep it up if you're not facing a selective pressure to do so.
If there's no reason to do that, then why bother?
Yeah. Island biogeography.
Yeah. And so nests would be used for long periods of time. And because of that, they would gather a lot of bones from captured prey, including birds, reptiles, and bats.
Happy Halloween.
Now, what's kind of interesting about that is the owls would, as their excrement, would excrete pellets.
Are you sure they didn't barf them back up?
Unsure.
Okay. Because a lot of owls barf a pellet up rather than sending it all the way through their digestive system.
It is excrement of a kind, just not the other end.
I have not looked it up in the
okay, I don't know the...
But that is an important difference in my mind.
Okay. what hole it comes out of is
important.
If
you're horking up a little pellet versus sending it all the way through your digestive system for no good reason.
Sure.
Actually, thinking about the way that bird shit is, I've been pooped on by so many things. And birds, they don't urinate in the way that we think of. They excrete urea paste.
Yeah.
And that all comes out of the same hole and everything. So, like, bird shit doesn't... I would imagine they would have to barf the bones back up. I don't think they could send them out the other end.
The other end, yeah.
Based on how most bird digestive systems work.
I probably should have warned people if they were eating. Maybe stop. So I apologize.
Don't swallow the bones.
Don't swallow the bones.
Yeah. And don't bother with the fur either. You can't digest it. See, that's another thing I find interesting is that's a big leap to start eating. Well, no, if they were eating bats before, then I guess they already had that figured out.
They had a bit of that going on.
Yeah.
However they got these pellets out, they got them out. And sometimes these pellets would become fossilized.
Ooh.
And so examining the contents of the bones in these fossilized pellets has actually helped scientists to determine not only what the laughing owl actually ate, but what kind of animals were in the New Zealand bush prior to human arrival, which I thought
was
very
interesting.
When I was a kid,
we got to dissect owl pellets as a like primary school science project. And it was cool as hell. Just all these like mouse bones and stuff. It was awesome.
So that's quite interesting because the bones were typically, unless the bones are sort of, you know, in the ground or something, they don't tend to survive long in the archaeological record, I guess is kind of what you'd call it.
Yeah, those little bitty creatures.
Yeah, so they're tiny bones. Again, rats, small birds, lizards, that sort of stuff. Those bones aren't going to survive. So I was actually quite lucky that they got fossilized in this pellet form. And in one example they found, which was at Gooland Downs, which is in or near Nelson, scientists found, quote, 28 species of bird, a tuatara, 3 frogs, at least 4 geckos, a skink, 2 bats, and 2 fish.
Damn, end quote. She's been busy.
So also seems like they may have caught fish as well, potentially.
Lit.
Which is kind of interesting. In terms of the breeding, 2 eggs would be laid in September to October, with chicks hatching after about a month and then being reared over October to November. And the female would incubate the eggs all by herself, but the male would go out and hunt and then return to feed her, which is, I guess, pretty typical sort of behavior for a lot of different species of birds, is one of them sitting on the eggs.
I don't know a lot about the breeding behaviors of owls. That's not something I've never worked with owls.
Mm.
Big fan of their work.
Big fan of
they're pretty cool. I like to look at them. I like to talk to them.
Yeah.
I
did, yeah, they are cool.
Mm-hmm. They're a good call and response bird. Some birds don't care, but if you do an owl call, then you might get one back.
Yeah. One thing about these owls' behavior is that Wikipedia describes them as being gentle natured.
That makes me sad.
That's a bit sad. Yeah.
That's kind of on par though with, again, island biogeography. A bunch of naked apes show up and they're like, all right.
They don't have a fear of that.
Yeah, that seems fine by me.
Yeah. So let's talk about their extinction as well, because this I also found quite sort of interesting and slightly different in a sense to the bush wren, was laughing owls were quite common in the areas that they were found when Europeans arrived in Aotearoa, all the way up to sort of the middle 19th century, so the 1850s. After that is when they began to decline quite rapidly. However, it's possible that they were already declining before Europeans arrived, because they were quite common in Te Uruwera in the pre-European era, and then not so much afterwards. So it's unclear whether they were already sort of going down, but we aren't really sure, because by 1880 they were really rare. 1880 and sort of around that time is when a lot of mustelids, so stoats, ferrets, and weasels got introduced to New Zealand, so that pretty clearly correlates with when the laughing owl populations really tanked.
Yeah, they were probably eating the chicks, because I don't think a rat could eat an owl chick.
No,
because they're semi-precocial when they hatch, so they're not just naked and pathetic, like songbirds usually are.
So they
may be able to fight off a rat, but not a mustelid.
Yeah, well, kind of the interesting thing is with kia ora is, of course, they don't think kia ora actually contributed meaningfully to the laughing owl's decline, and probably the ship rats and Norway rats neither, because kia ora just became part of their diet. And they've been living with them for hundreds of years. You know, by the time Europeans arrived, they've been living with, you know, laughing owls and kia ora had been coexisting for approximately 600 years with potentially no huge impact. You know, they don't think rats actually contributed all that much to the decline of the laughing owl, which I thought was quite interesting. And so the last confirmed sighting was a dead individual in South Canterbury in 1914. So we definitely know that they were around at least until then, but unconfirmed sightings and people claiming they heard a laughing owl would actually continue until the 1930s. And there was one guy who apparently said he heard a laughing owl near Opotiki in the 1940s, but that, again, was unconfirmed. So we only really know that they definitely were still around in 1914. That's the last time we 100% knew that. There was a possible sighting in 1952 in Fiordland, where a weird bird was spotted flying overhead that had a, quote, most unusual weird cry, which might almost be described as maniacal, end quote.
Aliens. It's just aliens.
So, I don't think...
I mean, it could have been a kind of a messed up ruru. You know, every once in a while you hear a bird that's not doing its call quite right. You know.
Yeah, it's just...
Drink his coffee is too fast. It kind of burnt his throat.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But that one I found weird, because it's like, what, you saw a weird thing that you couldn't identify and it sounded kind of strange.
The only option is an extinct bird
that's been extinct for 40 years at that point.
Like, it was a barn owl.
It couldn't have been a barn owl. I'm pretty sure they're only found in the upper North Island, right?
Well, they're a vagrant species, so...
Maybe.
That's more likely than a laughing owl.
It is, that's true. Yeah, that's true. It is more likely.
And they are kind of... Yeah, they kind of have that disc-shaped face and a yellowy color to them.
That's true, yeah.
And, oh my God, they sound horrific.
Yeah.
They scream, they shriek, it's awful.
Maybe it was a barn owl.
It really could have been.
Yeah, it could have been a barn owl.
Mystery solved. You're welcome, everyone.
There we go. You heard it here first.
Yep.
Exclusive.
Uh-huh.
We solved... 50-year-old, 70-year-old even, mystery.
Mm-hmm. I would bet $1 on that.
They also think they found egg fragments in Canterbury in 1960, which they're not really sure of, because just trying to identify the species just by the egg fragments is...
I'm going to put that on barn owl as well.
Barn owl, you're saying is, but that would be barn owl. Yeah.
Because owl eggs are a little unique. They tend to be fairly round, which is not that common globally.
Yeah, sure.
So that may have been why they were like, owl.
Maybe. Yeah. So, you know, despite all these potential sightings and everything else, the scholarly community generally accepts that total extinction probably occurred around 1940, or at least by 1940.
Yeah.
They're pretty certain that they won't have survived beyond that. And again, the main sort of reason for that was the introduction of mustelids and also cats would have contributed as well, or would have been the main drivers that led to extinction. As I mentioned earlier, kia ora probably didn't contribute all that much, but they did actually think that until, I've written here until the late 20th century, but it was actually the mid-1990s. I was trying to be consistent with my notation, but it was, I think it was 1990... It was like either 1993 or 1996, somewhere around there. So the mid-90s was when they figured out.
Yeah, yeah. When the Barney movie came out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where were you?
Yeah. when they kind of decided actually kia ora didn't probably contribute to their decline. Again, because laughing owls used them as a food source for hundreds of years. And they'd been hanging out together for a very long time at that point. And
you can also get source and sink populations when a new pressure is introduced like that, where you have some areas that are free of that pressure that are reproducing abundantly and quite successful, and those populations can kind of overflow into areas where maybe survival is lower or reproduction isn't happening very successfully. And so it could be that even if the rats had an effect, if they didn't have that effect everywhere, the population could have remained stable by having some areas where reproduction was very successful, kind of making up for the fact that, you know, even if the chicks were getting eaten or the eggs were getting eaten somewhere else.
So yeah.
You can kind of enter an equilibrium.
Out. Yeah.
Kind of like when some of the rarer birds leave Zealandia, that can be a source sink situation.
Sure.
Where they may not survive to reproduce outside of the sanctuary, but new babies from the sanctuary will continue to kind of fill in those populations. So you can get sort of a deceptively large range for a species that's actually some of that range is not actually providing all of their survival needs.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So yeah, that could have been what was going on there as well. And they also, again, think that ship rats and Norway rats probably weren't a huge issue for these guys either. It was really the mustelids and the cats, those bigger animals, that really is what did them in, that they just couldn't handle.
Mm-hmm. And rats also, they're really much more opportunistic predators, whereas cats and mustelids, they're out for blood. They're looking for it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They're designed to be hunting
pretty
much exactly.
Rats are more owls. Like, oh, a naked, defenseless baby bird. Don't mind if I do. As opposed to, like, I'm out for birds. I'm looking for them.
Yeah, exactly. And other things that probably contributed to their decline and the eventual extinction was persecution, which I didn't realize was the technical term for going out to hunt birds for museums and specimens and stuff, which I thought was a very interesting term for that.
British Museum.
British Museum, yeah.
That can sometimes also mean, like, wolves in the US where they were hunted because people were like, wow, they're eating my sheep.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what happened with Kakariki as well.
Not Kakariki, Kia, right?
Kia was for attacking sheep.
Yeah, they were, like, chewing chunks off of sheep.
Yes, but Kakariki were also... hunted as well because they would eat crops, like grains and things. Mm-hmm. They'd come down and eat those.
Mm-hmm. They do love millet.
Yeah, they do love millet. But yeah, for these guys, it was mostly them being hunted for museum specimens seems to be what it was. Which, yeah, if you go and Google it, you can see quite a few specimens of these guys. Not done super well, I don't think, a lot of the time.
It's hard. You ever skinned a bone?
I shouldn't rag on them too much. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I've ruined a couple of starlings in my attempts. That's okay. We're not going to run out of starlings.
No, that's true. And the other thing was changes in land use, which I assume was things like intensification of farming and that sort of thing was, more
habitat.
Sometimes
change in land use is a euphemism for deforestation.
Yeah, I was about to say as well, loss of habitat, so deforestation. Yeah.
Draining wetlands, all of it.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, which again is pretty standard stuff for these sorts of animals. So that's pretty much everything that I have on these two birds. What do you think of the birds?
I mean, it's always bittersweet to learn about something that's extinct. Personally, what I find exciting about species is sort of their evolutionary trajectory. What do they do and how do they do it and why? And think about what is it that led this creature to exist in the way that it is. That's the difficult thing being in ecology and being in conservation is having to looking at a creature or a plant or an environment and thinking how incredible that this all exists and functions the way that it does, and just seeing a big old spanner thrown very violently into the works. That's always a difficult thing to face. We're in the middle of another mass extinction, so. But yeah, I think there's merit to talking about extinct species, especially these recent extinctions. Sometimes when it happened a long time ago, it feels distant, but these, it feels very preventable, and I think it also feels very present because they do have living relatives, close living relatives. And with the bush wren and the rock wren, the rock wren is very ecologically similar and it's very vulnerable for similar reasons. I think it's just a little luckier in that its habitat is a little harder to get to. I think that's probably why it's still around.
Yeah.
There's lessons to be had for sure. But it's also amazing to think about all the things that have been, at least temporarily, extinction has at least been delayed.
Yeah.
I have a confession, actually. I have never voted for Bird of the Year because I simply cannot make the decision. I think if I was held at gunpoint, I would not be able to.
It is your civic duty to do so.
I can't.
You get to pick five of them.
That's not enough. last year I was like, I'm going to vote for the banded dotterel. And they had like four different, there's too many dotterels. They're all threatened. And I want to vote for all of the threatened species, basically, which unfortunately is a lot more than five. Yeah. I just can't. That's a lifelong thing with me. As I cannot pick favorites. I mean, I can barely make
a decision. We're not asking you to pick a favorite. We're asking you to rank five of them.
Impossible. 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 I could maybe do it I was about to say maybe I could do it with lizards, but no.
Well, don't be like Lily. Go out and vote. It is your civic duty.
I care too much and I won't apologize for that. All I've done is spend my Saturday afternoon telling the fine people of the podcast listening community about birds, and I think that is enough of a contribution. I also think that what I spend 40 hours a week doing for a living counts for something, I hope.
No, you have to vote in this thing that ultimately doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, whatever.
So thank you, Lily, for coming on and sharing your knowledge about birds.
I've traveled really far. We're at my desk.
You're American, so you've traveled far from America. Not specifically for this, but just more generally.
Oh, God, no. I didn't sign up for this. Look at us. Sitting here in our bathrobes on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. Who wouldn't want to be doing...
I mean, this is similar to conversations we've had. God forbid I see you looking at a bird on the internet and I'm like, hey, do you want me to butt in for the next hour and tell you answer questions you didn't ask? Going on a walk with me is insufferable.
Well, because the other thing that we don't talk about on here is plants, which you also know a lot about, so we end up stopping a lot to look at plants that I don't know anything about.
And I take it personally when I don't know what a plant is.
Mm.
So sometimes progress is slow because I got to figure out what they all are.
Yeah. Did you want to tell good people where to find you if they want to find you?
Sure. Yeah. If you listen to the Patreon episode, I used to be post-grad hobbit, but I figured around 2 years after graduating, I should probably change that username. So now it is Haurupi Hobbit, HAUROPI_Hobbit. Which is Tereo for ecology. That's me.
What platform is that on?
Instagram. Sorry.
Instagram. Yeah. Don't just go Googling on Twitter or X, formerly known as Twitter.
No, that's the only one I meaningfully use. I'm on Tumblr, but don't ever find me there. Don't you dare. Don't go looking.
Don't look.
It's not that username. You will never find me.
So, yeah, thank you again for coming on and sharing your knowledge. Yeah, I mean, well, I'm just going to make an outro, so.
Oh.
So we can just leave it there. Thanks again to my partner, Lily, for coming on and sharing their knowledge. If you want to vote in Bird of the Century, voting opens on the 30th of October and closes on the 12th of November. I've put a link to the Bird of the Century voting page in the show notes. And as I mentioned at the top of the episode, you don't need to live in New Zealand to vote. You just need a valid email address. You get to rank 5 different birds, so get out there and let your voice be heard. Remember, this is part 2 of our Bird of the Century episodes. So if you want more bird facts, check out the other episode next to this one. If you want to send me feedback, ask a question, suggest a topic, or just have a chinwag, you can find my email and social media on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt AOTEAROA. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts and sources. You can help support Hans through Patreon, buying merch, or giving us a review. It means a lot, and help spread the story of Aotearoa New Zealand. As always, haere tu atu, hoki tu mai. See you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host
Niñas Bien podcast. We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.